Executive Power, Disc 4.
Things began to make sense for the head of Mossad. At first he thought Jabril was invited to the terrorism summit as a mere financial representative, but now he saw there might be more to it. It was possible that with his fundraising prowess, he was able to call such meetings himself in order to distribute cash. A recent piece of intelligence clicked in the back of his mind, and he reminded himself to look more deeply into something one of his people had told him just this morning. Friedman eyed David and asked,
"And what of you? What do you hate? Or should I say, who?"
"I try not to hate. It leads to poor decisions." Friedman scoffed at the thought.
"It can also be a great motivator."
"Yes, it can," replied David. "But look where it has gotten us." David watched as Friedman retreated back into the shadows, an expression of scornful disagreement on his face. Watching him react the way he did, David wished it was within his means to kill the man right this very moment. He could probably do it and forfeit his own life, or spend the rest of his days in an Israeli jail, being tortured and otherwise treated like a subhuman. But suicide was not in his plans. Maybe an opportunity would someday present itself, but for now he would have to make his deal with the devil. It saddened him, however, to know that Friedman would go on using his indiscriminate weapons of war to kill the people of Palestine. Ben Friedman held much in common with the men David was meeting with this evening. It was too bad he couldn't talk him into coming along. A black attaché case appeared from under the table, and then another. Friedman placed them both in front of David and said,
"As you requested."
He laid one of the cases flat, opened it, and spun it around.
"Each is lined with 5 pounds of C4 plastique. You requested it, so I assume you know what you're doing."
There had been a debate between the top counter-terrorism people and Spielmann late into the evening yesterday. The question was, how would Spielmann's asset pull this off? Was he going to use the cases as a suicide bomb, or was he going to somehow leave the meeting place and remote detonate the devices? The debate was evenly divided, with Spielmann saying it was impossible that Jabril Khattabi would commit suicide, and the analysts saying that their money was on the Palestinian turning himself into a martyr. This split among his own people led Friedman to take several precautions. David nodded and examined the cases. They were basic black Samsonite attaché cases. He would weigh them when he got back to his apartment, and had little doubt that he would discover the Israelis had put more than 5 pounds of explosives in each. David extended his hand. "The detonator?"
"As you requested."
Friedman handed over a black digital Casio watch.
"Press the split reset button to arm the cases, and then the start-stop button twice within 3 seconds to detonate."
"Thank you." David took the watch and studied it briefly before placing it inside the first case. "Just so you know, Mr. Friedman, I plan on making more than one stop." Friedman frowned, not quite understanding what was meant by the remark. David grinned. "I am not so naive as to think this watch is the only detonator. I also know that my life means nothing to you, so don't get any ideas about detonating the cases on your own. I will be led on a long journey tonight, changing cars often, and stopping at many houses until I reach my destination. Only I will know when the time is right. And although I know it is impossible for you to trust a Palestinian, believe me when I tell you that I want these men dead every bit as much as you do." Friedman accepted the statement with a nod and said,
"It's your operation.
However you want to handle it is up to you." "Is there anything else I need to know?" Friedman hesitated. He had many questions, but now was not the time. If this Palestinian proved himself tonight and managed to survive the blast, they could sit down later. He shook his oversized head and said,
"No."
As David gathered the cases, he heard the tired voice of his friend, who was still sitting, observing the two strange allies.
"Why, Jabril?"
David turned to look at Spielmann. There seemed a genuine sadness in his eyes.
You do not know?
Maybe, but I would like to hear it from you.
David nodded thoughtfully. His mind rested upon the truth, and he said,
These men who I am going to see do not want peace, and as long as they are the leaders of my people, we will only know hatred and death.
With that, David grabbed the cases and left the room. Chapter 19. The U.S. Air Force Special Operations helicopter streaked across the calm, moonlit waters of Leyte Gulf. Up ahead loomed Naugat Island and the site where two of their fellow warriors had been gunned down just days earlier. Only one of the men in the helicopter was on active duty, but that didn't matter. Once a SEAL, always a SEAL. Coleman and his team were coming to settle the score, but somewhere else in the interior of the island, under the thick jungle cover, was an American family that was undoubtedly scared witless. The former commander of SEAL Team 6 wished he could do something to help them, but right now, that was out of his hands. Coleman and his men had moved to the side doors of the bird, two men to each side, their feet dangling over the edge, each man clipped to a safety harness in the event the helicopter had to make a drastic evasive maneuver. They were all wearing night vision goggles, giving their eyes ample time to adjust. In addition, Coleman was plugged into an in-flight headset so he could communicate with the pilots. As he peered out the port door, he listened to the chatter. The pilots were reporting four contacts on the FLIR moving toward the island from the east. They were right on time. To help mask their insertion, Coleman had asked that choppers from the Belleau Wood make an overflight of the island while they were being inserted. The big CH-53 Sea Stallions would fly just south of the target area while the Pave Hawk came in from the north under a ridgeline. Coleman wasn't at all worried about being picked up on radar. They would be flying too low for that. The problem was that when the sun came up, they needed to be in position a little less than a mile from the general's camp. In order to do that, the Pave Hawk would have to drop them off closer to the target than he would have liked. The sentries at the field command post would probably never hear the Pave Hawk's rotors in the heavy, humid tropical air, and if they did, they might think nothing of it. But if the general decided to send out scouts, it could be a problem. Coleman wasn't in the business of taking unnecessary risks when a solution as simple as arranging a flyover was available. The calm water vanished from beneath them and was replaced by a light, sandy beach, and then the thick jungle canopy. Coleman looked straight down, peering over the toes of his jungle boots. They were so low he felt as if he could reach down and grab a leaf. The helicopter began to climb as they worked their way up a ravine using their terrain avoidance, terrain following radar to hug the treetops. The pilot calmly called out 1 minute to insertion as the chopper weaved to the left and then back to the right, as if it were meandering its way upstream. Coleman tugged on his leather gloves to make sure they were tight and placed a hand on the heavy coil of rope that lay between himself and Kevin Hackett. The pilot called out 30 seconds to insertion, his voice just a touch tighter this time, and then asked his door gunners to report in. The men, one on each side of the bird, looked out past their ominous 7.62-millimeter miniguns and scanned the area, reporting all clear after just a moment. One by one, Coleman and his men undid their safety tethers and grabbed onto hand straps on the sides of each door. Coleman's heart quickened and his chest tightened a bit as the helicopter started to slow. He'd gone through this drill hundreds of times, and it never changed. He'd seen men die fast roping in near-perfect conditions. It was not something to be done half-assed. It was a task that needed to be performed with great care and focus. The second Coleman heard the go word from the pilot, he chucked the thick rope out the door and tore off his in-flight headset. Without hesitation, he reached for the rope with one hand and then the other. Coleman launched himself out the door, pulled the rope close to his chest, and then loosened his grip. He dropped like a stone for the first 30 feet, and then, with 10 feet to go, he put on the clamps and slowed his descent. His boots broke the surface of the stream, and he stopped knee-deep in water. Coleman moved away from the rope, bringing his suppressed MP-10 up and sweeping the banks of the stream, his NVGs piercing the dark recesses of the area. Over his earpiece, he heard each of his men call out as they hit the ground, announcing they were clear. In the wake of the rotor wash, the men moved quickly through the water to a predetermined rallying point on the east bank of the stream. The Pave Hawk rotated 180 degrees as the ropes were pulled back up and then started its descent back toward the ocean. Normally, the ropes would have been dropped and left behind, but Coleman and his men didn't have the time to gather and bury them. They needed to get to their mountaintop before the sun came up. The entire insertion took less than 10 seconds. Coleman and his men moved out immediately, never looking up at the chopper as it left the area. Wicker took the point, followed by Coleman and then Hackett and Strobel. They moved in the stream carefully, picking their way through the rocks. Their eyes and ears were receptive to the slightest sign that they were not alone. Their first order of business, to put as much distance between themselves and the infiltration point as possible. The Philippine Army helicopter approached the island from the southwest, the edge of the rising sun casting an orange glow across the thin horizon. Rapp sat in the back of the Bell UH-1 Huey with a special forces colonel from General Rizal's staff. Rizal did not like the idea of sending Rapp into General Morrow's camp unaccompanied, so he had sent along his most trusted aide to make sure nothing happened to the mysterious American. Rapp wasn't crazy about having someone looking over his shoulder, but he had to admit if anything went wrong, it would be nice to have a high-ranking Philippine Special Forces officer around to settle things down. Rizal had assured him that Colonel Barboza was not a fan of General Morrow. Barboza had served under Morrow and was highly suspicious of his actions. The proof that Rapp had brought with him had confirmed some of what he suspected and much more. Fortunately, Colonel Barboza wasn't a big talker. Rapp had been with him now for over 2 hours, and the officer had scarcely spoken a word. They'd boarded General Rizal's jet back in Manila just before 4 a.m. and flown to Surigao in the central Philippines. They then jumped on board the Huey for the relatively short flight over to Dinagat Island. Rapp had made only 2 calls on his secure satellite phone during that time. Both had been to Irene Kennedy. One confirmed that McMahon was in position to keep an eye on Ambassador Cox, and the second confirmed that Coleman's team had been successfully inserted. Whether or not they were in place was still unknown. Rapp had the ability to contact them directly, but resisted the urge. Having spent most of his career in the field, he understood that they'd let him know their situation as soon as they were able. The plan was for Coleman to call him when he was in position. Chapter 20. David had been given very simple instructions. At 6 p.m., when the narrow streets of Jerusalem were choked with traffic, he was to be dropped off at the All Nations Church on Jericho Road and then walk north. His Range Rover pulled up in front of the church 15 seconds early. David took a moment to gather himself, and then, after thanking his driver, he stepped from the vehicle and onto the curb. He was resplendent in an expensive dark blue 4-button Italian suit, white dress shirt, sans tie, and black shoes. His eyes were covered with chic black sunglasses, and his thick black hair was slicked back behind his ears. David's classic good looks ensured that he always stood out in a crowd. But waiting in front of the church, within view of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, holding 2 identical attaché cases, he drew even more looks than usual. He set the 2 cases down and fished out a pack of cigarettes. After lighting one, he stood there, trying to look relaxed, one hand in his pocket, the other holding the cigarette. He took a few earnest drags and surveyed the area. The church that he was parked in front of was a favorite tourist spot for Christians. The All Nations Church, or the Church of the Agony, as it was known by the old-timers, was not the ideal place to start such a journey. Having grown up in the city, David couldn't help but be aware of the 3 religions. Each of them, he had noticed from an early age, loved to commemorate pain and suffering, but none of them more so than the Christians. David looked up at the ornate pediment that sat atop the church's colonnade. The gilded mosaic depicted the agony of Christ as he prayed to his Father the night before he was to be crucified. David glanced to the north at the small garden of Gethsemane and its well-tended olive trees. They marked the spot where Jesus was betrayed by Judas and arrested. As the believers of the 4th major religion would have said, he was surrounded by bad karma.
He had little doubt that his Palestinian cohorts knew little of Christianity and Judaism, and what they did know were mostly lies propagated by racist caliphs, imams, and sheikhs. The Jews were, of course, the most savaged. The Muslim leaders repeatedly told their flock that during Passover, Jews sacrificed young Palestinian children and drank their blood. The ludicrous and unchallenged lies perpetuated themselves from one generation to the next. David looked to the place where Jesus had been betrayed. He knew of no Palestinian clever enough to intentionally start this journey from a place of such biblical importance. Besides, if they had the slightest clue that he had met with the head of Mossad, they would simply grab him and torture him until he revealed everything. They would never play some elaborate game. It was not the way of his people. They were too driven by emotion. The early evening sun was still fairly high in the sky as he looked up and down the street. They were out there watching him, Palestinians and Israelis alike. David hoped that Ben Friedman wasn't so dumb as to try to trail him for the entire journey. Security for such a meeting was very tight. If the people who were to transport him got even the slightest whiff that they were being followed, they might easily abort. Tonight's meeting, though, would be a bit different from the usual. They were all waiting on him this time like greedy little children. They wanted their cash, and that meant they would take risks to make sure he got there. Still, David wondered what Friedman and his spies from Mossad were up to. David had specified that no transponders be placed in the attaché cases. The reason for this was obvious. The security people in charge of the meeting would be carrying countermeasures that would detect just such a device. Friedman would know that, but David knew that Friedman would also never trust him enough to just let him wander off with 14 pounds of plastic explosives. He'd verified that weight as soon as he'd gotten back to his apartment that afternoon. Friedman's people had put 7 pounds of the lethal explosives in each case rather than the 5 he asked for. The yield of each case had been increased by 40%. This would make his mission all the more difficult to pull off, but he had a plan that would hopefully enable him to walk away unscathed. After throwing his half-smoked cigarette into the street, David grabbed the 2 cases and started north. At the first intersection, he crossed the street and continued on his way, passing the tomb of the Virgin Mary on his right. He'd walked almost another block when, without warning, a blue Toyota van came to a sudden stop next to him and the side door slid open. David, having done this many times before, casually veered to his left and stepped into the waiting van. They were moving again before he was seated. Someone from behind threw the door closed, and then the man in the seat next to him began frisking every inch of his body, starting with his left ankle. Chapter 21. Each step was taken with great care. Smaller rocks lying at odd angles were avoided while the men searched for firmer footing. They kept their separation at all times, Wicker setting the pace, and each man in succession responsible for not falling too far behind or bunching up. This very act, this art form of moving silently through total darkness on an unblazed trail with a 30-pound pack in hostile territory, was perhaps the most difficult thing for a Special Forces soldier to master. All 4 of the men picking their way through the jungle tonight excelled at this silent skill. They'd made steady progress since the insertion, but the terrain did not lend itself to a rapid pace. Coleman was beginning to doubt that they'd be in position by sunup. At the rare moments when the jungle canopy parted, he could tell the sky was quickly going from black to dark gray. He checked his watch. The sun would be starting its crawl over the eastern horizon. Clutching his MP-10 in his gloved hands, Coleman looked down through his NVGs in search of firm footing so he could boost himself over a fallen tree. As he placed his right foot on the moss-slick tree, he looked up to check on Wicker and froze. Charlie Wicker was standing completely still, his right hand held up in a fist. Coleman's own fist snapped up without hesitation, signaling the men behind him to freeze. The former commander of SEAL Team 6 searched in vain to see what had spooked his point man. After several tense moments, Wicker gestured for Coleman to join him. He could have used his headset to call for him, but used hand signals instead. Coleman silently slithered over the log and carefully made his way to Wicker's position. Wicker turned, cupping a hand over Coleman's ear, and whispered,
"There's movement up ahead."
Coleman's eyes strained to see what he was talking about, then whispered back,
"I don't see a thing."
Wicker pointed to his ear, meaning he'd heard something.
"Animal?"
asked Coleman. Wicker shook his head.
"Definitely human. I'm going to sneak a peek."
Coleman nodded and shooed him on his way. Keeping his eyes on Wicker, he raised his hand above his head and gestured for Hackett and Strobel to join him. If Wicker ran into trouble, they needed to be in position to help him out. When the other two were at his side, he briefed them on what Wicker was doing, and then the three of them moved forward one by one. They continued up the left side of the small creek to a point where it flattened. The rocks were replaced by a grassy bank. They moved forward in a crouch, treading lightly and staying close to the drooping branches of the trees. After rounding the next slight jog in the creek, Coleman sighted Wicker about 40 feet ahead of them, kneeling next to a tree. He also, for the first time, heard the voices that had spooked his point man. It sounded like two men talking in hushed tones. Coleman didn't like this development one bit. As far as islands went, Dinagat wasn't very small. Over 30 miles in length and 12 across, there was only one main road that ran north-south, and they weren't anywhere near it. The odds of them accidentally running into a couple of locals at this remote juncture and this early hour were minuscule. Coleman's thoughts drifted to the dark memory of the two seals who were lost on the beach not far from where he stood. He'd seen the proof of how that mission had been compromised, but for the life of him he couldn't imagine how this little covert endeavor could have been blown. Rapp had assured him that the circle of people who were in the know was tiny, and the number of people who knew the exact specifics, such as insertion points and times, was limited to just their war party and the pilots who'd ferried them in. But still, they weren't alone out here in this jungle, and it would be light soon. Coleman watched as Wicker turned toward him with the single lens of his NVGs protruding from his face. Wicker pointed toward his eyes with two fingers and then held three fingers up in the air, telling Coleman that he had three enemies in sight. Wicker then waved him up. Coleman turned to Hackett and Strobel, pointed at them, and then held a clenched fist in the air. They both nodded their confirmation, and then Coleman moved out. It took him the better part of a minute to reach Wicker, and on the way he noticed the smell of tobacco in the air. This made him feel slightly better. It was improbable that anyone waiting to ambush him and his men would be dumb enough to smoke cigarettes. But then again, Coleman had seen people do a lot of truly stupid things in the field. When he reached Wicker's position, he saw the men standing approximately 50 feet from them. They were on the opposite side of the creek, next to what appeared to be a bridge made of fallen trees and stones. Water trickled from under the bridge as the creek dropped several feet into a circular pool of water that meandered its way toward them. A thin mist hung in the air. Coleman noted the small waterfall and the noise it produced. The trickling sound would help conceal their own approach. The two tangos were carrying AK-47s with their distinctive banana clips, and the third man was carrying a rifle that he couldn't quite make out. The weapons were slung over their shoulders, muzzles pointed down. Coleman frowned at the stupidity of such a move. Whoever these three Filipinos were, they weren't very smart, and if they'd ever received any formal military training, they'd already forgotten all the important parts. After watching them for another moment, Coleman decided there was no way they were here to spring an ambush. They were more than likely Abu Sayyaf, and the way they were acting suggested they weren't too worried about security. If this was the best the Islamic terrorist group had to offer, the former SEAL Team 6 commander felt pretty good about the odds of the rescue operation succeeding. There was also the possibility that the men were part of a local militia or workers for one of the island's farms. The intelligence dump he'd received on the island told him that with Abu Sayyaf roaming about, everyone had armed themselves. Seals were normally very good at patiently waiting and watching an enemy, but right now Coleman needed to get his team to the top of the mountain that was still a quarter of a mile straight uphill. There were three options. The first, most straightforward and least desirable option, was to kill the three men and get on with their mission. If he knew with any certainty that they were Abu Sayyaf, he'd gladly pull the trigger himself. The downside of that, however, was that they had to come back down the mountain when they were done, and three missing terrorists might bring some unwanted attention to the area. The easiest course of action was to do nothing. Wait until the men moved on, and then proceed. But time was not a luxury at this point. They needed to get moving, and they needed to do it fast. That, unfortunately, meant backtracking a bit and then moving through the jungle to get around the men. Any way he sliced it, they were running out of time. Coleman didn't want to admit it yet, but it was looking more and more like they wouldn't be making it to the top of the mountain on time. Coleman felt Wicker's hand on his bicep. He turned to see the point man walk two fingers in front of his face, signaling that more people were approaching. The man's hearing was supernormal. Coleman, who was no novice in the woods, hadn't heard a thing. Suddenly, the three Filipinos by the bridge threw their cigarettes to the ground and stamped them out with their sandaled feet. One by one, they unshouldered their weapons and tried to look alert. Coleman heard someone speaking Filipino to the men from farther up the trail. Suddenly, there was another flurry of activity. Two of the men rushed to the other side of the small bridge and took up positions as the fourth man appeared from the jungle. Coleman saw that the man was carrying an M-16, and both he and Wicker ducked behind the tree at the same time. There was no mistaking the profile of the new man. He had on a pair of night vision goggles. They lay completely still behind the tree, listening for the slightest indication that they'd been spotted. After what seemed like an eternity, Coleman peered out from the opposite side of the tree. From his new vantage, he could only see one side of the bridge. The man with the goggles was nowhere to be seen. Carefully, he slithered on the ground, backing up at first and then working his way toward the creek. Once again, with a full view of the bridge, he found the man he was looking for. The man had flipped his NVGs into the up position and was talking in Filipino to the two men on the far side of the bridge. He pointed in the opposite direction from which he'd come, and the two men immediately took off down the trail. The man with the M-16 then pulled his goggles back down and began scanning the area. Coleman smoothly drew back behind the tree. The wisest thing for them to do right now was to sit tight. It was better to lie still than risk attracting attention. Running down the list of possibilities, Coleman wondered if their insertion had been noticed and the guerrillas were attempting to set up a picket. If more men arrived and they began working their way down the stream, it would be a foregone conclusion. Thinking ahead, the commander began to plot an ambush. If they had to, they could do it on the fly. Coleman would leave Wicker where he was, and the commander and Hackett would collapse to the middle. They'd let the enemy work their way down the stream far enough until they were fully flanked by his position, and then they'd unload with Strobel and Wicker working their way from the outside in, and he and Hackett the inside out. It would not be difficult for them to take down at least 12 men before a warning shot was fired. Coleman was about to fall back when he felt Wicker tightly squeeze his arm and not let go. Looking over, Coleman saw that his point man was looking at the bridge from the other side of the tree. Slowly, Coleman peeked out from behind the right side. He blinked twice in disbelief. It took him a moment to process what was happening on the small bridge and another moment to realize that his finger had moved off the guard and onto the thin trigger of his MP-10. Chapter 22. Coleman watched in disbelief as five Caucasians, two adults and three children, passed before him like a dream in the mist, their blonde and red hair a stark contrast to the black hair of the armed men who walked with him. They were tied to each other, a sagging link of rope in between each frail, malnourished individual. The mom in front, two kids in the middle, and the dad slowly bringing up the rear, carrying the youngest of the brood. They looked ragged and underfed, but alive. The column moved across the bridge and down the trail. A rear guard loitered for a few seconds, then wandered off lazily after the group. And, just like that, they were gone. Coleman, who had just moments before cursed their bad luck, was now rejoicing in their fortune. In the midst of a jungle, in the middle of the Philippines, they had just stumbled across a family of Americans for whom thousands of men and women had been searching. Getting into position to support Rapp's mission was his priority, but this was an opportunity that he might not be able to resist. Wicker leaned over and whispered in his ear,
"I counted 21, plus the family."
Coleman nodded, and then pointed for Wicker to move forward and check things out. With his hand cupped over his lip, Mike, he said,
"Kevin and Dan, get up here."
A minute later, they were gathered near the bridge. The sky was getting lighter by the minute. While Coleman briefed Hackett and Strobel on what they'd seen, Wicker checked out the path to make sure no one was lagging behind or doubling back. When the point man returned, Coleman quickly laid out their options. All four men looked to the top of the mountain where they were supposed to be by the time the sun was up, and then looked down the narrow, muddy path where the family of kidnapped Americans and their captors had gone. More than probably any other military outfit, SEALs were taught to think independently in the field. But none of them were prepared for this. They had a mission to fulfill, and Coleman wasn't about to leave Rapp to carry on alone. But he sure as hell didn't like the idea of losing the Andersons. His loyalty and respect for Rapp and the SEALs who had been abandoned on the beach was unquestionable. But so was the innocence of the American family, held against their will for months on end. Strict protocol dictated that he get his team to the top of the hill as quickly as possible and radio in the sighting of the Andersons. Common sense told him that this accidental sighting of the missing family was too good an opportunity to pass up. Satellites and reconnaissance flights were incapable of penetrating the dense cover of the jungle, making any hope of searching for the Andersons by air hopeless. If Coleman radioed in their position, it would take a day or more to insert a team. By that time, the trail was sure to go cold. Looking again to the top of the hill and then down the trail, Coleman continued to struggle with what to do. The answer suddenly came to him in the form of a question. What would Rapp do? The answer was obvious. The solution was less than perfect, but under the current situation, the best choice. The former SEAL team commander gestured for his men to take a knee, and then, very specifically, he laid out a course of action. Chapter 23. They had traveled north to Ramallah and then to Nablus, changing vehicles in each city. This was standard procedure. Both cities lay on the west bank, and despite Israeli control, there were certain enclaves in each that the Jews would not venture into unless they were in an armored column spearheaded by tanks. David hadn't a clue as to when or where the meeting would take place, only that it would definitely be after dark. Heading north could merely be a diversion before they reversed course, or they might simply meander through one city or the other until they were convinced they weren't being followed, and then stop at the appointed place. As darkness began to fall, they pulled into a parking ramp. David was swiftly ushered from the yellow Palestinian taxi he'd been riding in to a white Israeli taxi parked next to it. David was asked to lie down on the back seat, and a blanket was placed over him. The transfer complete, they sped from the ramp and began winding their way through the streets of Nablus. Approximately 20 minutes later, they stopped. The blanket was pulled from David, and once again, he was told to get out of the car. For a second time, he found himself standing in a dimly lit concrete parking garage. He hadn't the slightest idea where he was, other than somewhere on the West Bank. Across the aisle, three men were standing by the trunk of a car smoking cigarettes. Two of them had machine guns slung over their shoulders, and the third one David recognized instantly. His name was Hassan Rashid. He worked for Palestinian General Intelligence, which was the official intelligence organization of the Palestinian Authority. The agency was supposed to help combat terrorism and work toward a lasting, stable relationship with Israel, but as with everything connected to the PLO, it was rotten to the core.
Hassan Rashid was a street thug who had been a disciple of Yasser Arafat's since childhood. He'd grown up in Nablus and became very active during the First Intifada of 1987, but not in the way one would expect. As the conflict grew more violent, Arafat saw an opportunity to consolidate his power, and he broke with the Palestinian extremist groups by calling for a Palestinian state to coexist alongside Israel. This was Arafat's first real gambit to gain respect from the international community. It presented a real risk, however, since it was outright blasphemy for an Arab to want anything other than the complete destruction of the Jewish state. Because of Arafat's bold move, the various groups under the loosely allied Palestinian United National Command splintered. Islamic Jihad and Hamas turned on Arafat, and the blood began to flow. Rashid, who had one real talent in life, helped protect the PLO's standing in Nablus by brutalizing any and all Islamic extremists who stood against Arafat. It took great effort on David's part to conceal his hatred for the man. As he stood with his two attaché cases, he watched Rashid flick his cigarette through the air. It hit the ground and cartwheeled toward him, the burning tip breaking apart and showering his feet with red sparks. David looked up slowly from his shoes. Rashid was looking back with a smug look on his scarred face. His longish, hooked nose was pulled farther to the side by the lopsided smirk on his lips.
"Well, pretty one, what have you brought for us this evening?"
David decided not to reply. He had risen to untouchable heights, and if Rashid persisted in his schoolyard bullying, he would have to remind him of his place. Rashid started toward him.
"Come now, you're still not mad at me after all these years?"
"No," David feigned sincerity. "I love you like a brother."
"Ah, come now, pretty one, we all know you liked it."
"Oh, I loved it. In fact, maybe we could get together sometime, and I'll shove a cattle prod up your anus. Knowing your affinity for little boys, I'm amazed you haven't already tried it." As David said this, he saw the smile vanish from Rashid's face. The man raised his right fist and from two steps away began to let loose an emotional roundhouse punch. Taking David for an easy, defenseless target, he put little thought into his technique or balance. Most of the punches that Rashid had thrown in recent years had been at men tied to a chair or strung up. His street-fighting skills were not what they once were, so when his target made a swift sidestep, his wild punch missed its mark with such force that it spun him around. David was done taking crap from the man who had plucked him from the street as a young teenager and tortured him for having too many Jewish friends. It had been 20 years since somebody had told the PLO that Jabril Khattabi was a sympathizer, and they had dispatched Rashid, the street thug, to teach him a lesson. Now David was ready to repay the man who had destroyed his youth. With a quick sidestep, he had avoided the punch, watching it sail past his face. Setting himself into a quick 360-degree spin, he kept the case in his left hand low and brought up the case in his right hand. He completed the spin just as an angry Rashid squared himself for another charge. The bottom corner of the hard black attaché case hit with a bone-splitting crack that smashed the man's nose and sent Rashid careening off his feet and into the trunk of a parked car. The wall was aglow with screens relaying images shot from all around the West Bank and even a few taken from outer space. Ben Friedman was filled with anticipation. He had forced himself to use great restraint in deploying his assets. A deft hand would be needed to strike the blow he intended. Tonight he would avenge the deaths of hundreds of innocent Israelis. The Palestinians that Khattabi was going to meet were the masterminds behind the wave of suicide bombings that had rocked his country and crippled the Israeli economy. Under Friedman's orders, Mossad technicians had placed a highly sophisticated device in each case. In essence, they were homing beacons connected to a GPS device and a timed burst transmitter. Every 5 minutes, the devices turned themselves on for 6 seconds. The GPS recorded the position of the cases to within 2 meters, and then the burst transmitter sent an encrypted message to a satellite in geosynchronous orbit. The devices then powered off so they wouldn't be picked up by an electronic countermeasure. Friedman understood better than anyone the draconian measures his enemy employed to keep their activities secret. He, in fact, was the reason for much of their paranoia. He had hunted and killed them in such a wild variety of ways that it had now been several years since he had gotten anyone close enough to take real action against them. The Director General of Mossad had significant experience in the arena of assassination. In 1972, when 11 Israeli athletes were taken hostage during the Munich Olympics by the Palestinian group Black September, Ben Friedman had been there. He had stood at the side of his mentor, legendary Mossad Director General Zvi Zamir, while the German police bungled a rescue operation that resulted in the deaths of all the Israeli hostages. To add insult to injury, the two surviving terrorists were later released by the German authorities for fear of reprisals. Israel had nowhere to turn for justice, so they looked to Mossad. It was Zamir who had convinced then-Prime Minister Golda Meir that they must seek vengeance. Meir agreed and directed Zamir to hunt down the masterminds behind Black September and eliminate them. Over the next 9 months, the blood flowed, and Ben Friedman proved himself to be one of Mossad's most efficient assassins. His first hit was barely a month after the massacre of the Olympic athletes. Mossad wanted to send a signal to everyone, and their first target was Wael Zwaiter, a PLO representative in Rome. On October 16th, Friedman approached Zwaiter from behind while the man was on a walk and put two bullets into the back of his head. 2 months later, Friedman was part of a team that killed Mahmoud Hamshari by placing a bomb in the phone of his Paris apartment. The device was detonated by remote control, and the PLO representative was decapitated. Blood continued to flow, and Friedman's crowning achievement came on April 13th, 1973. He was part of a select force of Mossad agents and army commandos that launched a raid into the heart of Beirut. The targets that night were three of the PLO's most senior officials. Mohammed Najjar, Kamal Adwan, and Kamal Nasser were all gunned down in their homes. The success of the operation had implications far beyond the deaths of the three leaders. Information seized during the raids led to the assassination of three more terrorists with ties to Black September. The victory, however, was short-lived. Just 2 months later, Mossad was to suffer its most embarrassing public moment. The disaster occurred in the sleepy Norwegian ski village of Lillehammer. A team of Mossad agents were sent to investigate a possible sighting of the terrorist Ali Hassan Salame. The inexperienced group incorrectly identified the target, and then proceeded to kill Ahmed Bouchiki, a Moroccan waiter. If that wasn't bad enough, six of the team members were subsequently captured while trying to escape. The men and women were put on trial, and five of the six were jailed. The international outcry was deafening, and Mossad was officially ordered to get out of the assassination business. Fortunately for Ben Friedman, he had not been involved in the Lillehammer incident, for if he had, it would have marked the end of his career. Instead, the disaster in Norway served to remind him and many others that they needed to hone their skills further and redouble their efforts in their covert war against the Arab aggressors. Despite the official ban on assassination, Friedman and his group of kidons continued to hunt the terrorists that plagued his country. His crowning achievement came when one of his kidons infiltrated Hamas. One of the group's leaders and bomb engineers had been a particularly nasty thorn in the side of Israel for some time. His name was Yehya Ayash. The Israeli assassin took a phone call for Ayash on a phone that had been modified by the technicians back at Mossad. He then handed the phone to the Hamas leader and walked away. Seconds later, a tiny charge of C4 exploded, blowing a hole in the side of the terrorist's head and killing him. Tonight, the stakes were much higher. Ayash had been but one terrorist, whereas this evening there would be many. Others would be sure to sprout up and take their place if he were successful, but it would take the enemy years to recover from such a blow. Hopefully, by then, all Palestinians would be expelled from the occupied territories, and a long, tall wall would be built once and for all, separating the two tribes. and then they could turn on each other. This Jabril Khattabi was a good example of what they were capable of. Friedman had no doubt that if they ever got to the point when they no longer had Israel to blame, they would simply self-destruct. Friedman's thoughts were interrupted by the voice of one of his people.
"It looks like he's changed cars again."
The director general looked up at the wall of screens. On the left were 12 TVs, 6 high by 2 wide. In the middle were 4 large screens that measured 4 by 6 feet each, and on the right there were again 12 TVs. On one of the big screens, a red laser dot marked the roof of a white sedan that was moving through traffic. One by one, screens flickered as they were changed from one camera vantage to another. The advanced surveillance room wasn't all that different than a news control room. Right now, the surveillance team's director and his 2 assistants were busy changing camera angles. At their disposal was an amazing array of surveillance equipment, 2 satellites, over 1,000 traffic and security cameras from all over the country, a specially equipped surveillance airplane circling the area at 15,000 feet, and several helicopters were about to join the fray just as soon as the sun slid over the long expanse of the Mediterranean. Friedman watched and listened as his people worked computer consoles and joysticks, carefully directing teams in the field to attempt a visual confirmation that their man was still in the car. Friedman leaned forward into the glow of the screens and cautioned his people not to push too hard. The attaché cases were the key. He had to take Jabril at his word that he wanted these men dead every bit as much as Friedman did. If he was right, Jabril would do everything in his power to prevent the money from being transferred to a bag or some other case.
Chapter 24. Rapp jerked open the helicopter door and stepped to the ground. He scanned the perimeter of the landing area, looking for the general, even though he doubted the officer would be so polite as to meet his visitors as they landed. Colonel Barboza joined him, and they walked underneath the spinning rotors of the Huey. At the edge of the landing area, the 2 men were greeted by an eager lieutenant dressed in BDUs, jungle boots, and a black Special Forces beret. He saluted Colonel Barboza crisply and introduced himself as General Moreau's aide-de-camp. With that brief introduction out of the way, the man did an about-face and led them down a path. The place was a standard military field camp, located in a grassy clearing about the size of 2 football fields. It consisted of 2 rows of big green tents set atop wooden pallets. From the satellite photos he'd studied, Rapp knew what each of the 16 tents were for, which ones served as bivouacs for the troops to sleep in, which tent was the mess hall, medical tent, command center, and, most important, which was the general's tent. What Rapp hadn't been able to glean from the satellite photos was what perimeter security was in place along the tree line. On the plane ride over, Coleman had mentioned it was very curious that there was no barbed wire laid out around the camp's perimeter and no foxholes or machine gun nests dug into the obvious defensive positions. In Coleman's mind, Morrow was either derelict in his command or had very good reason not to fear an attack by the guerrillas. At the expected tent, the aide stopped and rapped his knuckles on a wooden sign that, amazingly enough, had the general's name on it. As a matter of course, U.S. Special Forces personnel in the field went to great lengths to hide the rank of officers. There was no saluting. Rarely was rank displayed unless in a subtle way that could only be noticed up close, and men were taught not to all stand facing a commander as he talked. This last part was the most difficult to teach, since the military had drilled the chain of command into their heads from their first day of boot camp. Morrow was either very proud of the fact that he was a general, or he had no fear of letting the enemy know where to find him. Rapp suspected the sign on the door indicated a bit of both. From inside the tent came the word, "Enter." The voice was not menacing, casual, or aloof. If anything, it sounded merely a bit curious. As he stepped into the dark tent, he was forced to take his sunglasses off. There, sitting behind a small, portable desk, was the general in a pair of camouflage pants and a green T-shirt. Rapp immediately noticed that the general was in tip-top shape. His arms were long and lean, with powerful biceps straining against the tight fabric of his shirt. The general made no effort to get up and greet them, and Rapp casually observed the interaction between Barboza and Moro. He watched the junior officer salute his superior in a way that was within the proper guidelines, but was noticeably lacking in both enthusiasm and respect. It was the bare minimum required by the military protocol, and nothing more. Barboza turned, waving an arm toward Rapp, and said, "This is Mr. Rapp. He works for the CIA." The smallest of smirks formed on the general's lips. It may have been a smirk of recognition, or just a show of disrespect for the CIA. Rapp watched Moro with the detached, analytical eye of a professional. The general made no effort to get up and shake his hand, and Rapp made no effort to extend his. The two men silently studied each other until the mood grew uncomfortable. Rapp had a strategy to employ, and a crucial part of it was to keep Moro off balance until the time was right. Moro sat motionless, his hands gripping the armrest of his wooden canvas chair. Rapp had played this game before, and he was sure the general had also done so countless times with his subordinates and probably even a few American military advisers and State Department officials. What was different this time was that Rapp wasn't some American diplomat who was worried about offending the general's sensibilities. Rapp was intent on doing much more than that, and he sincerely hoped that in the process he would thoroughly upset the diplomatic apple cart. It was the general who blinked first. His smirk turned into a full-blown smile, and he asked, "To what do I owe the honor of receiving the infamous Mr. Rapp of the CIA?" Rapp took the insult as a compliment. He had two choices. He could either maintain the cold attitude of a man who obviously distrusted Moro, or he could join the general in his parlor game and try to gain his trust, or, at a bare minimum, ease his mistrust. He decided on the latter. With a smile of his own, Rapp replied, "There is no honor in receiving me, General. I'm just a humble bureaucrat in the employ of my government." This caused Moro to laugh loudly. "A humble bureaucrat! That is good!" The general slapped his thighs enthusiastically and looked at a confused Colonel Barboza. "Colonel, I see you have no idea of the fame of the man you have brought to see me." It was obvious that Moro enjoyed this advantage over the younger officer. "You should read more. Mr. Rapp is an American icon. Mr. Rapp is America's counter-terrorist." Rapp did not join in the general's laughter. He found very little humor in what he did for a living. When Moro had settled down, Rapp said, "General, if it's all right with you, I'd like to have a word in private." Moro looked from Rapp to Barboza. He studied the colonel for a moment with a look on his face that hinted of a deep-seated contempt. "Colonel, you are dismissed. I will send for you when we are done." Barboza remained impassive. He saluted the general and then turned to Rapp. "I will be waiting for you outside." When he had departed, Moro offered his visitor a chair. Rapp took a seat and settled in. "I assume," Moro started, "that since you are America's counter-terrorist, that you are here to discuss the progress I have made against Abu Sayyaf." Raising an eyebrow in surprise, Rapp replied, "I wasn't aware that you've made any progress." The general chose to ignore the comment, instead smiled and said, "Your agency is famous for getting its facts wrong, Mr. Rapp. I don't know what you have been told, but the terrorists have suffered over 100 losses in the last month alone." "So you say," replied Rapp with a straight face. Moro could not let this pass. Indignantly, he asked, "Are you questioning my honor?" Rapp wanted to say that it was worthless to debate an attribute that the general did not possess, but that might push him too far in the wrong direction. Ignoring the question, Rapp said, "General, I am a practical man, and I have been told you, too, are a practical man, one with amazing capabilities." Rapp threw in the last part as a blatant attempt to flatter the general. "We both know what it's like to be in the field with politicians beating on us for results. I'm not here to attack your integrity, but I do know for a fact that your men have not killed even half the enemy that you've just claimed." Morrow sat motionless for a moment, struggling between admitting the truth or sticking with his propaganda. He decided to do neither.
Mr. Rapp, what is your point?
My point is, General, that I know things about you that your own government does not. Rapp let the innuendo hang in the air. He could feel the comforting lump of his Beretta under his right arm. He would not hesitate to kill the snake sitting across the desk from him. Coleman and his team appeared to have run into some trouble, so it looked like it was up to him to handle the situation. He'd already pieced together a plan that he felt would work. If Morrow made the slightest move for his sidearm, which was in its holster hanging from a peg on the tent pole behind the general, Rapp would have to ad-lib a bit, but he was still confident that he could accomplish his mission and avoid being torn limb from limb by the general's troops. Once he showed Morrow the goodies, there was a very real chance that things would spiral out of control. With a furrowed brow, no doubt caused by Rapp's unsettling words, Morrow tried to figure out why this assassin had come to visit him. The first and most obvious answer was quickly dismissed. Morrow's men were fiercely loyal to him. The American would never make it out of here alive if he were to try to kill him. With a disarming smile, Morrow said,
"Mr. Rapp, you have me at a disadvantage. I have no idea what you are talking about."
Salty sweat poured down Coleman's camouflage-painted face as he tried to keep up with Wicker. It was a hopeless task. Wicker, a decade younger and 30 pounds lighter, seemed to have an inexhaustible source of energy as he scampered up the mountainside. This was not to say that Coleman was past his day. It was rather that Wicker was a very unusual man. He could move through the jungle in near silent fashion at a pace that was impossible to match. Coleman was wise enough to factor all of this into his decision before they started their scramble up the hill and had told Wicker not to wait for him. Back near the footbridge, Coleman had made the difficult choice of splitting his team in two. Strobel and Hackett were to carefully track the terrorists, while Wicker and Coleman went on to support their primary mission. This was one of those battlefield decisions that would either be looked back on as ingenious and gutsy or glaringly stupid. Like a football coach deciding to go for it on fourth down rather than kicking a field goal, the wisdom of such a decision is always dependent on the success of the gamble. The physical screening process for SEAL candidates is well known, but what is often overlooked is that the men who run the Naval Special Warfare Training Center in Coronado place an equal amount of importance on intellect and character. In short, a physically strong warrior who follows orders makes an ideal infantry soldier. In the modern battlefield, their every move is monitored by a battalion, brigade, and sometimes even a force commander. They are chess pieces on a very intricate board that need to be moved in a precise way. The world of special forces, however, is very different. A physically strong warrior is a good start, but a strong, intelligent warrior is absolutely dangerous. SEALs are taught from day one that operations rarely go as planned. It's drilled into them that quick, intelligent decision-making will invariably enhance the chances for a successful mission and contribute to the very survival of their unit. They need to be able to operate behind enemy lines, often without the aid of artillery and close air support. They are rarely involved in major battles unless their mission is to take out a select, high-value target prior to the launching of the main battle. In short, they are taught to operate independently from their command within mission parameters for sustained periods of time behind enemy lines. It was not in Coleman's character to abandon Rapp, but the kidnapped American family had appeared like a gift out of the pre-dawn mist. It was a gift he could not pass up. Coleman paused briefly to catch his breath and take a drink of water from his camel pack. He placed the small hose between his lips and sucked in a mouthful of water. Wicker was far ahead of him now, at least 75 yards. He caught a glimpse of him as he scrambled over a rock shelf and disappeared from sight, a shadow moving in the shadows. Coleman started again in earnest, on all fours, pawing and pushing his way up the steep mountain. He was both thankful and leery of the cover provided by the trees that enveloped the landscape. They traveled in the same gully that ran from the top of the mountain all the way to the sea. At times, it was like a gorge, and at others, a babbling brook. Up on this high, steep part, there were more exposed rocks and less grass and moss. The torrential rains of the region washed away anything that wasn't anchored down by the roots of the trees and the surrounding undergrowth. It would be nearly impossible for anyone below to see them. They traveled just off to the side of the gully, where the leafy limbs of the trees provided good cover. Coleman worried about what might be waiting for them at the top. Mountaintops are a prized possession among opposing forces. They offer a bird's-eye view of the lay of the land and provide crucial intelligence. They also offer a nice perch to set up a counter-sniping team. Sniping in the Special Forces is a life-and-death game played at the highest intellectual level. A sniper does not fear machine gun fire, artillery shells, or bombs from the air. A sniper fears the bullet of another sniper. Snipers will lay in wait for days, slowly, cautiously scanning every inch of the landscape, section by methodical section, to make sure they don't become the target of someone staring back at them through a high-powered scope. Fear of snipers, more than any reason, was why they wanted to be in position by sunup. Unfortunately, that precaution was out of their reach. They would now have to hope that they were the only men around with long barrels. Coleman pressed on, his thighs burning with each foot that was gained in his quest for the relatively short summit. The pain was ignored, and the pace was quickened. His lungs took in and exhaled a steady, efficient supply of oxygen. He reached a sheer 11-foot wall of rock. He was about to scale it when he noticed the trampled undergrowth to his left, indicating Wicker's passage. Without hesitation, he plunged through the foliage. When he got back to the gully, he looked up and saw Wicker within striking distance of the summit. Coleman put his head down and redoubled his efforts. He figured it would take him no more than 2 minutes to reach the top. Chapter 25. It looked like the roulette wheel would stop on Hebron, a Palestinian city of over 100,000, 20 miles south of Jerusalem. In the 50-plus years of Israeli statehood, Hebron had been a city caught in the middle. Located in a mountainous region, it was home to the tomb of Abraham, a prophet revered by Muslims, Jews, and Christians alike. A small community of Orthodox Jews lived near the center of the town, but they numbered less than 1,000 and had to be protected by a garrison of Israeli defense forces. The Palestinians resented the fact that a single Jew lived in their city and had tried countless times over the last century to rectify the problem by means that were less than humanitarian. The terrain lent itself naturally to urban guerrilla warfare. Narrow streets that wound up and down hillsides flanked by multi-story stone buildings with flat roofs. Blind corners abounded, and streets stopped and started without warning. Israeli soldiers steered clear of much of the city, knowing if they went in, there was a good chance they might not make it out. In short, Hebron was Palestinian-controlled territory. It surprised David not in the least that this was where the meeting would take place. His altercation with Rashid in the parking garage had been extremely satisfying. If Rashid and his men understood anything, it was force. They had seen their boss bested, and bested easily by a younger man who, by virtue of the meeting he was about to attend, was somebody important. Still, David didn't give them much time to react as they gawked at the bloody Rashid lying unconscious on the floor. He yelled at the men to get moving and climbed into the white Israeli taxi. The men hesitated, not sure what they should do. "Leave him," he ordered. "When I tell Mohammed Atwa what he has done, he will be grateful that you left him here." This was a name that stirred genuine terror in the Palestinians. The three men did not hesitate to obey. Mohammed Atwa was the head of Palestinian General Intelligence, an organization that many Palestinians feared more than Mossad. The security service was known for torturing and killing suspected collaborators with impunity. Atwa had even resurrected the old practice of killing Palestinians who dared sell their land to a Jew. He also happened to be the same man who ordered the torture and interrogation of David when he was a young teenager. David looked out the window of the sedan as they meandered through the canyon-like streets of Hebron. Darkness had fallen, and they were no longer in the white Israeli taxi. Driving such a vehicle into Hebron would be akin to walking through Harlem in full Ku Klux Klan regalia. Instead, they'd switched to a yellow Palestinian taxi. As they rounded a tight corner, they came to a sudden stop. A group of masked young men immediately surrounded the car. They carried a variety of weapons, from Russian-made AK-47s to American-made M-16s. All four doors of the sedan were yanked open, and everyone was told to get out. David was searched once again for a transmitter. When one of the men stepped up and tried to grab the attaché cases, David stopped him with a stern rebuke. He placed both cases on the trunk of the car and opened one and then the other. The packets of neatly bound $100 bills left the men momentarily awestruck. The nicely dressed young man they were dealing with was apparently someone very important. David slammed the cases closed before the guards had time to gather their wits. Acting impatient, he grabbed each case and told the men he was not to be delayed further. With the vision of millions of American dollars still fresh in their heads, none of them argued. David was walked through the barricade and placed in the back of a minivan. The van raced up the street, turning several times. On each corner, men stood watch with assault rifles at their sides. 6 blocks later, they stopped in front of a 3-story house. Both sides of the street were clogged with parked cars. David grew nervous for a second, and then saw the vehicle he was looking for. The Mercedes sedan was parked just on the other side of a van. David breathed a sigh of relief, knowing that the armored car belonged to Mohammed Atwa. Clutching the attaché cases, he stepped from the van and walked toward the house. His arms suddenly felt very heavy, and everything began to slow down. He looked down at the cracked sidewalk and then slowly up at the 2 masked men standing guard in front of the blue wood door with chipped and peeling paint. The men were gesturing for David to hurry, but he didn't hear what they were saying. He just casually placed 1 foot in front of the other, and then the next thing he knew, he was in the house. There were people everywhere. It was as if a party were going on. Smoke and loud conversation filled the air. To the room on his left, there was a virtual banquet, mounds of grilled lamb, shashlik, moussakhan, and chicken liver. A middle-aged man who ran the Popular Liberation Committee in Gaza was popping baklava into his mouth and nodding enthusiastically to the head of Force 17. Over in the corner, he saw 2 men sipping Arab coffee and discussing something in earnest. One of the men he knew to be the head of security for Islamic Jihad, but the other man he didn't recognize. David felt his throat tighten a bit. This was the culmination of meticulous planning and great patience. It was almost exactly as he dreamt it would be. He looked to the right and saw a big screen TV. It was tuned to Al Jazeera, but it seemed no one was paying attention. 3 large couches were arranged around the TV. They were filled with men, some of whom David recognized. This was the closest thing David had ever seen to a terrorism summit. There were representatives from the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and at least 1 from Beirut. There were several new faces from the martyr brigades and many old faces from the PLO and its only true rival, Hamas. Through the crowd, David saw Mohammed Atwa approach. David forced a smile to his face and lifted the 2 attaché cases in the air. Atwa, the head of Palestinian General Intelligence, the torturer of thousands, grabbed David by the cheeks and, standing on his toes, kissed the younger man's forehead. With a flourish, Atwa turned and waved a theatrical arm in the air. "He is here! Our son has returned from visiting our rich Saudi friends!" Everyone fell silent for a brief moment, and then the room broke into applause, toothy grins, and nods of enthusiasm. This was the apogee of 2 years of hard work. David had started small, working his way up the ladder of the Palestinian Authority. His first donation had been $10,000. From there it got bigger, and as his stature grew, he worked his way closer to Atwa. The power behind the power. The man whom he someday would kill. David knew if he were to ever see a Palestinian state, Hamas would have to be dealt a vicious blow. The Islamic fanatics would never be happy until every last Jew was dead, and when that happened, they would only be satisfied if a Palestinian state were run by clerics who enforced strict Islamic law. Even the radical PLO looked tame next to the crazed members of Hamas. David had cautiously counseled Atwa to bring Hamas into the fold by providing them with capital. The agreement was that David would use his skills to raise money, and Atwa would hand part of that money over to Hamas to finance their terrorist and martyr operations. As David's fundraising prowess grew, so did Hamas's reliance on PLO support. David was so successful that Atwa was also able to entice some other groups to the trough. They included Islamic Jihad, the Popular Resistance Committee, and Hezbollah. Tonight had been billed as a watershed evening for the groups. The last month's fundraising had been so fruitful that they would all gather under the benevolence of Atwa and the PLO to divide the spoils. Atwa relieved David of one of the attaché cases and grabbed him by the arm. Excitedly, he led David between two of the couches to a spot in front of the big screen TV. Atwa turned his case around and opened it for the group to see. He nodded for David to do the same.
$2 million, my friends!
The room broke into shouts and praise for Allah. Men jumped to their feet and began hugging each other. The irony of seeing these cold-blooded killers act in such a light-hearted way made David smile to himself. What idiots! Not only was the money counterfeit, courtesy of the Iraqis, but there was an even better surprise in store. Atwa set the attaché case down on the table, and David did the same. Turning to one of his lieutenants, Atwa handed him a sheet of paper that explained how the money was to be distributed. Then, overcome with the emotion of the moment, he grabbed David and hugged him. Patting him on the cheek like a son, he told David how proud he was of him. David kept up his act and shrugged off the compliment. It was no big deal.
Yes, it was, and don't say it wasn't.
Atwa stuck a finger in his face to warn him against any more modesty. Then, looking around the room, he began to frown and asked, "Where is Hassan?" David hesitated just briefly and then seized his chance. "I need to talk to you about that." Atwa's lined face became concerned. "What has happened?" David looked over one shoulder and then the other. "Not here, not in front of the others." After looking around the room one more time, David gestured for Atwa to follow him. The two men walked through the crowd, David stopping every few feet to accept another hug or handshake. He feigned reciprocity as the men showered affection on him, which was made all the more difficult by the fact that he was about to send them to their deaths. As they stepped outside, Atwa stopped, his look of concern now much deeper. David pointed to the butcher's Mercedes sedan. In private, David walked around the other side and climbed into the back seat. Atwa joined him, and when both doors were closed, David breathed a barely discernible sigh of relief.
This ends Disc 4.